Like I said, we started this program of paranormal reporting, and we invited all comers. You know, and so we have had, you know, tons of Sasquatch reports. I mean, one of the things my wife and I joked about is it seemed like everyone who we met down here either knew somebody or had had a Sasquatch encounter themselves. Mm-hmm. And so for many folks down here, that's just one of those things that's very common. We get a lot of UFO reports, a lot of glowing orb reports, a lot of strange cryptid reports. People report, you know, time lapses and spatial displacement. I've even had one of those experiences myself recently. Yeah. But we've also had, so like I said, we've had close to over 300 reports, and over 100 of those are regarding this creature we call the Klickitat ape cat. So basically, everyone who makes these reports describes a very large, muscular, panther-like creature. With jet black fur and a long tail.
Welcome to a Broaderlands podcast. The opinions expressed on Broaderlands Podcast are those of the guest speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host or Broaderlands Podcast.
Broaderlands Podcast, it's an honor and privilege to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And it, I look forward to learning from you. And, you know, maybe I could have you share a little bit about your background and your upbringing, if you don't mind.
No, sure. Yeah. So currently, my wife and I own and operate an outdoor adventure store in the Columbia River Gorge. And we came into that about 3 years ago when my mother-in-law passed away. She had a number of businesses in the Columbia River Gorge. And my wife and I decided to continue those businesses. And the gorge is a really unique place. And as soon as we sort of, you know, opened for business as an outdoor adventure store, folks started coming in and telling us all kinds of strange stories about Sasquatch encounters and UFO encounters. And so I put up the big sign in the window that said, file paranormal reports here. And since then, that's a little over 2 years ago, we've had more than 300 reports. So it's been pretty amazing. Really fun. It's, you know, sort of like a new Scooby-Doo mystery walking through our front door a couple times a week. And so it's been just incredibly satisfying and compelling to listen to folks' stories and get a chance to do some investigation and those kind of things. Prior to running the stores, way back, I was an infantry soldier with the U.S. Army in the 199th Special Battalion. I was a wildland forest firefighter, mountain guide, and more recently, I was volunteering my time as a nationally certified search and rescue EMT. And so the notion of coming to the gorge, and which is just a adventurer's wonderland, was kind of like winning the lottery. And then to find out layered on top of all that are all of these amazing and mysterious things going on down here. And so we'll get into all that, I'm sure, as the talk continues.
Yeah, I'm excited. Were you always interested in this kind of stuff, or this just happened recently?
You know, even way back when I was in the military, I joined the Army when I was 19, and I had some unusual experiences there. And so I've always been open to the idea. And since moving to the gorge, we've had some unusual experiences as well. And maybe I should paint for your listeners a picture of what the gorge is like. So the Columbia River Gorge is in the Pacific Northwest. It formed the Columbia River is the largest river in North and South America that flows into the Pacific Ocean. And it forms the border between Washington and Oregon State. And my businesses and my home are in Washington. Now, the gorge is an 80-mile stretch of the river. It's one of the most stunningly beautiful places on Earth. Like, even way back in the 1980s, Congress got together and, in a bipartisan move, actually created new laws to protect the gorge. And so the gorge became the nation's first national scenic area. basically what that means is that we enjoy a lot of the protections against development that a national park enjoys, but people are allowed to live here and work here and run businesses here. So my store is sort of in the middle of the gorge. We're about 60 miles east of Portland, Oregon. So when people come to visit, they fly into Portland, drive east. And so the Columbia River runs through the Cascade Mountains. And so that means that you can go from basically sea level to 3,000 feet in less than half a mile. There are these towering cliffs all along the way. We've got over 90 named waterfalls. Some of them are over 600 feet tall. The western half of the gorge is a brooding and mysterious and gorgeous Pacific Northwest rainforest. And so you can imagine the tall Douglas fir trees and, misty kind of an environment. And then the east side of the gorge is actually a desert. So the mountains form a rain shadow. And there you've got flat-top mesas and, you know, desolate landscapes and a thing called the Scablands that are out there with these insane rock formations. There are over 600 caves in the area. Within 35 miles of my store, there are three stratovolcanoes that are perpetually covered in glaciers. And all of them are active volcanoes. And so Mount St. Helens famously erupted in 1980. And then we've got Mount Adams, which is a giant UFO hotspot that's just north of us. And then just south of us is Mount Hood, which is a huge Sasquatch hotspot. And so people come here and they whitewater raft and they mountain climb and they go caving. They do paragliding and windsurfing and all those kind of things. So it really is just like if it was a video game, this would be the world's coolest, like, open world map you could possibly imagine. I mean, it's got everything here. And so for a guy like me with all of my outdoor adventure experience, it was just super exciting. It was sort of like winning the lottery to come down here and be able to live and work. And then, we started this paranormal reporting program. And, you know, because I've had some experience with this stuff, and also like looking at what happened with when the U.S. military started allowing people to make reports and not ruining people's careers, a lot of people started coming out of the woodwork and, you know, a lot of pilots and things started telling their stories. So when we started the program, I gave very special instructions to our staff. I said, I want you to treat everyone who comes in here with an unusual story with the utmost respect. You know, ask intelligent follow-up questions. Don't belittle them or laugh at their stories. And importantly, do not inject what you think they experienced out of their experience. You're just there to take the data. Wow. It has been, like I said, just an amazing journey. And, you know, one of the most incredible and satisfying parts of it is that you make these connections with people. You know, we talk to people who had experiences when they were teenagers and now they're in their 50s and they have never told anyone before. And to be a safe place that people trust, that, you know, they can talk about these things and we'll listen to them and we won't act like they're crazy. The connection that you make with people has really been rewarding.
I love that. Thank you. And I love that you provide a safe place for people to share their experiences where they can feel safe and normal, because a lot of people shun them or laugh at them and make them feel kind of outcasted in some kind of way. And so I appreciate that.
Yeah. What's really great is, we advertise that this is a service we provide, and I'm pretty well known. The gorge, there's not a ton of people here, like maybe 80,000 people live out here in distributed amongst, probably 10 or 12 towns. And, but I'm getting to be fairly well known and people will come up to me in restaurants or in the grocery store or stop me at the post office and say, hey, I've got to tell you about this Sasquatch encounter I had or this UFO I saw. And, we moved from Seattle down here and part of the charm is, when you move to a small town, it's those community connections. And that's really been super enjoyable. Really, really fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. How would you invite someone that is a skeptic to this conversation?
Well, I would say that when you look at the earliest records of human thought, so we're talking about 40,000-year-old cave paintings, like in Lascaux, France, or in Spain and those different places. From the very beginning of humans recording their experiences, they have depicted impossible creatures. So therianthropes, which are human-animal hybrids, chimeras, which are combination animals, things which seem impossible by the laws of nature as we currently understand them. And as you go through time, on every continent where people have lived, and in every single culture, and in every time era, people have discussed these kind of unusual phenomena. And for many cultures, it was always their best and their brightest that were talking about it. Like you think about, it was the shaman, it was the pharaohs, it was the high priests of the Aztecs. Even today, our best minds are the ones that are thinking about alternate realities and multiverses. Like, this is what high energy physics is all about. And so, you know, you can, the problem is that mainstream science works on a world model that's based in materialism. And if certain phenomena doesn't fit into the world model, they reject that phenomena. They say it's not possible. And that's kind of a silly way to go about it. If you think about it, like if you had the actual landscape and then you drew a map of it and then you took that map away and someone said, well, I'm here in the landscape and I see this feature. And they say, well, it's not on the map, so it can't exist. It's not the map that you trust. It's the actual experience that you trust. And the evidence is overwhelming. Like basically every single culture on Earth has experienced what we would call supernatural. And modern science can't explain it, so they try to ignore it. And that doesn't seem like the most intellectually sound approach to the material. You look at what our government is doing, they are now taking UFOs seriously. They're saying that we have footage and sensor data which is showing objects which do not obey the laws of physics as we currently understand them. And so you can't say that serious people don't take it seriously. I mean, no one gets more serious than the Pentagon. And then you look at guys like Benjamin Franklin, all right? So he, back in the 1740s, electricity is a crazy sorcerous power. No one understands it. And this joker is out in his backyard during a lightning storm flying a kite, right? He's got to seem like a total nut job to his neighbors. But we all know that he was one of the smartest, brightest, most intellectually curious guys out there. And, you know, in some ways, you think about, since modern science, mainstream science has really kind of put paranormal stuff in a corner and said, yeah, we're not going to really pay attention to it. That leaves this wide open space for citizen scientists to come in and look at field data and propose theories. I mean, I don't have to worry about, you know, my academic reputation or getting my funding pulled or anything like that. You know, I'm sort of self-sustaining here. And I would say that the truly intellectually curious can't deny that there is something going on here. There's some kind of phenomenon that is outside of our current world model, but is definitely impacting the trajectory of human society.
Yeah, thank you. And you got me thinking about the Sumerian cuneiform tablets, yeah, and even the ancient Kemetic or Egyptian hieroglyphs. They always had
every culture talks about it. Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, if you think about it, like in any given society, you've got the best and the brightest, which are going to follow the evidence where it leads them. They're the most intellectually curious. They've got the best processing power. Then you got sort of the unwashed masses, and we all have a sense that there is something going on. Like, you know, many, many common folk, you might say, may not be able to do the math, but we certainly have a sense that there's something more to the world that's going on. And there's really just this very thin band of people with their arms crossed saying, everyone else in history is an idiot, and I'm the only one who knows what's going on. And, but I find that those are typically the most mediocre minds, of anyone that I talk to.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. In your area, the Klickitat ape cat is pretty well known in your area. And I seen you give a talk with a glyph of a cat, an ancient, like, I don't know, maybe a thousand years old or so. Maybe you can help broaden our lens on that topic.
Sure. Yeah. So, like I said, we started this program of paranormal reporting, and we invited all comers, you know, and so we have had, you know, tons of Sasquatch reports. I mean, one of the things my wife and I joked about is it seemed like everyone who we met down here either knew somebody or had a Sasquatch encounter themselves. Mm-hmm. And so for many folks down here, that's just one of those things that's very common. We get a lot of UFO reports, a lot of glowing orb reports, a lot of strange cryptid reports. People report, you know, time lapses and spatial displacement. I've even had one of those experiences myself recently. Mm-hmm. We've also had, so like I said, we've had close to over 300 reports, and over 100 of those are regarding this creature we call the Klickitat ape cat. So basically everyone who makes these reports describes a very large, muscular, panther-like creature with jet black fur and a long tail. And also very, very large. So that's the foundational report. It's very curious because, of course, here in the Pacific Northwest, we have cougars. But all of the wildlife biologists that we talk to say that there is no such thing as a black cougar, right? It just is something which science doesn't recognize. Their only big black cats in North America are jaguars, but their range is 1,000 miles south of here. So sort of in your neck of the woods, southern Arizona, southern New Mexico, that kind of thing. And so here we are, and we've received over 100 reports of this enormous black panther creature. Now, about half of those reports are very explicit in saying that the creature is of enormous size. We're talking about something that is 4 to 5 feet tall at the shoulder. And so that is bigger than a tiger, which is the largest living cat recognized by science right now. So that's a pretty unusual thing. And then there's a handful of the reports, I would say about 10%, that explicitly describe that the creature has features that look like a monkey. So that's a really strange thing to hear. The very first report I got, this was a little over 2 years ago, and a gentleman came in. He knew my mother-in-law, and so he's kind of a friend of the family, not a super close friend, but Margie had interacted with him on a number of occasions. And it took him about 45 minutes to work up the courage to tell me his story. And he said that he was orienteering, using a map and compass out near an area called Buck Creek. It's about 3-4 miles from the store. And his compass started acting strange. Now, that in and of itself is not entirely unusual. The gorge is known to have many magnetic anomalies. In fact, when you look at the government navigation maps of the Columbia River Gorge, there are bright pink letters on them that say, warning, your compass readings will be off in this area. And a part of that has to do with the astonishing geologic history of the place. I have some theories that it is, in fact, our geology, which is why we so over-index on paranormal reports and activity out here. Just briefly, I'll go into how the gorge got to be. It's a pretty astonishing story. So about 20 to 30 million years ago, they estimate that the Columbia River started flowing. And so this is before there are any mountains. It's this waterway that's literally draining. This is during the Ice Age. It's draining those Ice Age glaciers into the Pacific Ocean. Then about 17 million years ago, this enormous fissure opened in the earth. This was at the Washington-Idaho border. This fissure was 100 miles long, and enormous gouts of lava began spewing out of this thing. In some places, this lava is 3 miles thick in eastern Washington state. If you took all the lava that came out of it and you spread it out across the U.S., it would cover the lower 48 states in 60 feet of lava. And so this truly apocalyptic eruption is going on, and it is flowing down the ancient Columbia River Gorge. It flows 300 miles all the way to the ocean. And it occurred in several different eruptive events that spanned over a million years. And so what happened was, as that lava flowed, it would cool. And as it's cooling, all of its magnetic material would orient towards the Earth's magnetic north pole. And then as it cools, all that magnetic material gets locked into place and it becomes solid. Then, you know, life happens, you know, plants grow in that lava and it becomes, you know, its own biosphere. Mm-hmm. Then maybe 10,000 years, 100,000 years later, there's another major eruption and lava covers that up. And so there are over 300 flows like this, but each time the lava flowed, the Earth's magnetic north pole has wandered. So in the last 100 years, the North Pole's wandered 700 miles. But over the course of 10,000 years, it's significantly more than that. And so each of the layers here, each of those layers, and when you look in the gorge, you can see them clearly. There's some cliffs that are 800 feet tall, and there's, you know, 10 to 12 different layers of rock you can see. Each one of those layers has got a unique magnetic signature because they've all been, they all cooled at different times and oriented towards the wandering North Pole. So then, about 2 million years ago, we had the Cascade Mountains start to form, and they start taking those layers and bending them and folding them in all these strange and crazy ways. And so that magnetic material, which was already a crazy jumble, gets bent. And then 15,000 years ago, if any of your listeners are familiar with the work of Graham Hancock or Randall Carlson, they'll know about the Younger Dryas floods. And so...
yeah.
What they believe happened was that during the Ice Age, this gigantic ice dam formed in Montana, in the Zula, Montana, and it filled up this giant lake. It's easily equal to several Great Lakes combined. And then in a day, that ice dam catastrophically failed, and the world's largest flood occurred. And so that water came rushing across eastern Washington. At some places, it was 300 feet deep, left these channeled scab lands as truly... fantastical landscape, and it comes through and it scours all of eastern Washington, and it gets backed up in this area of the gorge called Wallula Gap. So this is like this sort of thin place the water has to get through, and it all backs up there, and then the water starts rocketing down the gorge. And at this point, the water is moving, you know, 70 to 80 miles an hour. It's carrying logs and icebergs and giant chunks of rock, and it's just scouring every living thing, and all the topsoil is getting swept out to sea. Where my store is, that flood was 800 feet deep. In some places in the gorge is over 1,000 feet deep. And this flood lasts for a week, and it is truly a cataclysm of biblical proportions. I mean, nothing could have survived that was below that rushing water level. But what that did was, because it scoured away all the topsoil, it took all of those layers of different magnetic signatures and it exposed them like a live wire. All right, so we've got this really complicated, nuanced electromagnetic environment here. And that's further complicated by the fact that there are 14 hydroelectric dams on the Columbia River. And those dams generate enough power to light up a city the size of Seattle and seven more just like it. Right. So it is like 44% of all of the hydroelectric power in the United States comes from the Columbia Gorge River system and all of the dams on it. And then that power is then transported through the landscape through these transmission lines, you know, these high tension transmission lines. And so what I'm painting for you is a picture of this really complex and nuanced electromagnetic environment. And, and so the human brain has got magnetite crystals in the temporal lobes in the hippocampus. And so they estimate in some of those structures that there are 5 million these magnetite crystals per gram of brain matter. And those crystals are magnetically sensitive. And there have been studies up in Laurentide University in Ontario, Canada, Dr. Michael Persinger during the 80s did studies on what happens when you induce magnetic fields around the human brain. And he found that he could produce an array of seemingly paranormal experiences. People have sense presence, and he was able to turn fear on and off like a switch. And so we know that there is a physical mechanical mechanism whereby magnetic fields impact human perception. And we've had tons of reports out here. And so you could say, well, maybe what's happening is that, you know, people get into this environment, which is this unusual electromagnetic environment, and then they're experiencing personal hallucinations, right? Like, this magnetic field is influencing your specific brain structures, and you're having sense presences, or you're seeing things that aren't really there. Well, the problem with that analysis is that we have many, many reports that are co-witnessed. So multiple people see the same thing. We had a group of seven whitewater rafting guides that watched an enormous egg-shaped UFO for 45 minutes above the White Salmon River. And so we have co-witnessed events. We also have physical evidence. And so we have tons of Bigfoot footprints. We've got, you know, body castings. We've got hair samples, a lot of these different types of things. We also have photographs. I myself took a picture of a glowing orb just above the river a couple years ago before we even started our program. And through some photographic analysis, we were able to rule out that it was definitely not a lens flare. We also have photographs of UFOs. And so if it's a personal hallucination, you can't really, you don't expect co-witnessing, you don't expect physical evidence, you don't expect photographic evidence. So there's something else going on there. And if you think about like a radio station, like normally, if let's just say you're tuned to talk radio, and you walk into an environment and all you hear is talk radio and you think that's what reality is. But if you make a minor adjustment to your electromagnetic receiver, suddenly you can hear classical music. You make another adjustment and you can hear rock and roll music. You make another adjustment and you can hear country music. All those signals are present in the environment simultaneously. It's just that you're tuned to the talk radio station all the time. And so you think that's all that there is to reality, when in fact, all these other signals are present. It's just you're not, your tuner isn't aligned with those experiences. And so what I think happens is that people get out here, the electromagnetic environment adjusts their receiving apparatus, and suddenly they're tuning into stations that they normally don't hear. So anyway, that's a long-winded way. I was in the middle of a story about the ape cat, but it kind of helps to understand, you know, the environment that we're talking about here. Yeah. And so this guy came in and he said that, you know, this compass was acting strange. Then he looked up and across the river, he saw this enormous black cat. It didn't seem to be afraid of him. Very unusual. Cougars are known to abandon a fresh kill just at the sound of human voices. And the notion that this creature was unafraid of a human, very unusual. He said that it stood 4 to 5 feet tall at the shoulder. So that's just an enormous animal. Like, it's a terrifying thing. I cut out a silhouette of one and put it up by the store, and it's just horrifying to see something that enormous. Fortunately, we've had no hostile encounters reported about this creature. And so he, you know, told me his story, and he, you know, sort of at the end, almost sheepishly said, and, you know, the strangest thing was that it had a face that looked like a monkey. And I just could not wrap my head around that. Like, there's nothing in my experience that, you know, sort of has any of that make sense. This enormous creature, bigger than a tiger, bigger than the largest living cat, black fur, not afraid of humans, and has this intelligent ape-like eyes and primate features on its face. I was super excited. Of course, it's just one data point, so there's not a lot you could do with that. You know, it's like, okay, well, one guy had a story, and we have some ways that we check to see if, you know, people are being truthful. Like, you could tell by their demeanor if they're there to have fun or whatever. He checked all the boxes as a genuine experience. And so I was excited, but it was late. You know, we were closing up the store. So the next day I came in and I was explaining this report to my employees. And one of my employees, she became clearly emotionally engaged in the conversation. And she said, oh my God, I've seen that thing myself. And she was driving down Klickitat Canyon, which is, you know, maybe 10, 12 minutes east of the store. at dawn one morning, and she saw this enormous cat creature walking around near the side of the road. She actually stopped her car and watched it for some time. She didn't get a good look at its face, but she clearly got the notion that it had a long cat tail, cat-like movements, black fur. And she told her family that she had seen this thing, and they all sort of laughed nervously and told her that she had probably seen a cow, which is kind of ridiculous. I mean, any adult can tell the difference between a cat and a cow. I think that's not a hard call to make. But, you know, a lot of folks just want to normalize these strange experiences. And, you know, what we find is that if we resist that urge to normalize things, to immediately fill it in with something we know, it allows that mystery to become more present. Like, it gives us some handles to begin to look more deeply at. And it expands the horizons of the world in really amazing ways when you don't immediately try to fill that space just because you don't know what it is with something that you do know. And so with Missy and this customer both giving very similar reports, I thought, oh, well, we need to find out if more people have had this experience. Mm. And so we put up radio ads using the store's advertising budget, and we put up some flyers at the trailheads, and we just started asking people, has anyone else seen a big black cat? And I was astonished at the response. Tons of people started coming out of the woodwork. We heard about a guy who had seen the cat in his driveway, but it had a youngling with it, a kit, so a baby cat. So clear that these things are reproducing. We've had hunters say that they see it through the scope of their weapon. We've had, you know, a whole host of different encounters. And a lot of the encounters are honestly not very exciting. Like, someone will be driving their ATV and this big black cat jumps across the trail and scares the crap out of them, and they never see it again. We saw that thing wandering around in our orchards. And so we've had, like I said, over 100 reports of the creature. We've had senior law enforcement officials say that they've seen it. And the stories go back. The earliest report we've ever had is 1968. And so that's, you know, close to 55 years ago. And so they go pretty far back. Like I said, no hostile encounters. They seem to be primarily located in the gorge. Last summer, a woman posted a video of a creature that they had spotted. This was in the western area of the gorge. She posted it to like a Facebook community, like a closed community page or neighborhood page. And in the description, she says, we saw this large cat-like creature. It's definitely not a house cat. We know it's not a bear. We know it's not anything else. Anyone else know what it is? Of course, Facebook video, it looks like this little black blob squatch thing moving around in the field. It's not what I would call conclusive evidence, but there's definitely some type of quadrupedal black creature moving along. It's taller than the high grass that they've got there. So it's been a pretty amazing thing to, you know, see these experiences, you know, to hear people describe this creature, which is unlike anything recognized by science. You know, you can, you know, the monkey-like face, like, that's one that's hard for me to wrap my head around. And I'll get to a point, like, we won't have a report about the monkey-like face for a while. I'm thinking, maybe it's just like a reporting error, or someone, you know, had a bad light or whatever, and then some highly credible person will come in and repeat that part of the story. There was a woman who was a crew chief for a wildland firefighting team. They were out between St. Helens and Mount Adams up in the Gifford Pinter National Forest. The whole crew saw this thing on their first night of a 3-day deployment, and they were wondering what the hell they were going to do if it showed up in their camp at night. And so the way she described its face was that it was flattened, more flattened looking than most cats. So I suppose, like, if you took, you know, like the difference between like a healthy Doberman Pinscher dog and a, you know, like a pug dog, they're both dogs, but one's got a more flat face, you might construe that, you know, it's got, looks more monkey-like or human-like than one with a long nose. But again, you know, hard to say exactly what people are experiencing. So, of course, I did research. You're like, okay, well, what are we dealing with? There is a Native American tradition of a race of supernatural panther protectors. They're called the Meshepeshu. And when Native American traditions talk about something coming from the water realm or the sky realm or the earth realm, they're talking about a being that seems to have a foot in the spirit world and in the physical world. And these Meshepeshu are described as these, it's a race of underwater panther protectors. Mm. So they're these spirit world panther protectors. But what I found compelling was that one description said that it looks like a black panther with the face of a man. Sounds an awful lot like the type of creature we're dealing with. And there is a, so of course, the Columbia River Gorge is really sort of the first major, if you're coming from the north, like if you're, you know how there's that theory that two people populated North America by coming across the Bering Land Bridge, sort of from Asia through Alaska down along the coast. Well, the Columbia River is like the first major access point to the continent. You were dealing with mountains everywhere else. This is the first way to get in. So we have some of the oldest skeletons in North America, Kennewick Man. Any anthropology fans in your listeners might be familiar with, is just upriver from us. And so we've had things for millennia going on here, you know, 15, 20,000 years easily. And so there are these petroglyphs, and they're most visible in the desert side of the gorge. One area near a place called Horse Thief Lake has got, you know, a couple dozen of them. And one of them looks like this cat creature with these really intense eyes, you know, big jagged teeth. And it's got these wavy water lines under its head. And so we can't say for sure that even the Native Americans living here today do not know who created the petroglyphs or what they mean. And so, you know, we can only speculate. But I can tell you that before we even started our reporting program, I had an encounter in that area. So the Horse Thief Lake is in the sort of the desert side of the gorge, and it's in a scab land area. So when those floods came through, they ripped apart the rock and created this wildly bizarre set of rock formations. And there's this, like a mesa, so it's sort of like a flat top, steep-walled type of structure, like a rock structure. And from the road, it looks like just like any normal desert mesa. But when you get up close to it, you find that it is riddled with a labyrinth of hidden passageways and natural amphitheaters, and you can climb around in there. There are petroglyphs on the walls. And I was up there one June evening, and I was looking out, and you can look down through this sort of slot canyon, and you can see Horse Thief Lake, and then you can see where the petroglyphs are beyond that. And I was looking at the surface of the water, and I saw a creature swimming in there. And I could sort of gauge its size because there were, you know, ducks and waterfowl on the surface. And this creature that was swimming was dark in color, and it was definitely larger than a person, but smaller than a car. So somewhere in that size frame. And it seemed to be, you know, sort of circling the center or patrolling the center of the lake. And then it would submerge for up to 5 minutes, come back up. I watched it for like 20 minutes. That was about 600-700 yards away. So I couldn't really look at any of the details, but it really made me scratch my head. The number of large creatures that swim out here is pretty limited. You know, we have black bear. They're definitely decent swimmers, but they're typically point-to-point swimmers. They're not going to get out into the middle of a lake and swim around in circles, and they're certainly not going to submerge for any significant amount of time. We have elk, but again, they're not the kind to submerge, but they're the only creatures that have a body mass that's big enough to the creature that I saw. It could have been a sturgeon. We've got some of the largest freshwater fish in the world come from the Columbia River. Some of them like well over 15 feet long. But they're typically bottom dwellers. No reason for them to be on the surface. They're usually like sort of a whitish kind of color. So, and plus it was in the lake, but wasn't even in the river. So at the time, you know, we hadn't really had any reports. I hadn't heard anything about an ape cat, and I just chalked it up to, I don't know what the hell that is, but it is certainly something really unusual swimming around in Horse Thief Lake, right next to the petroglyphs and course, the feud itself, clearly a place of great spiritual power. The Native Americans would build these rock nests to go on vision quests. And so those are found throughout that whole area. So it was a place that seems like it's well tapped into, you know, some of the more spiritual aspects of the landscape. And so that was my first encounter with it. And so, you know, one of the obvious theories is that, okay, this is some type of supernatural creature that has been here for millennia. Another road that I went down was, okay, well, what type of creatures lived here during the Ice Age? And it turns out that there is a North American lion creature. Scientific name is the Panthera atrox. This is a creature that was 4 to 5 feet tall at the shoulder. It could weigh up to 1,100 pounds. And it was basically the largest cat that had ever lived on Earth. Interestingly, it had the largest brain pan as well. And so what we can say for sure, and there have been hundreds of fossils of this particular creature, primarily in the La Brea tar pits. They pulled out over 80 specimens. Mm. So this creature is well understood by science, but it's got much thicker bones and it's a very large animal. And so it's the only creature in the fossil record that matches the size of the animal people are reporting seeing. Interestingly, it had a sexual dimorphism, which means the males and females are physically different. In this case, the females are much smaller than the males. And so that may account for, you know, the size difference we see in the reporting. You know, some people say it's enormous. Other people just think they're looking at a big cat, could be mistaken for a cougar, but with black fur. So, you know, how a creature could have survived from the Ice Age, that's a tough one. You know, that's a 10,000-year span. And we don't know, like, other than the creature lived back then and we're getting reports of a similar creature now, that's the only connection that we can say about that. But surprisingly, I should also say that out here near Mount Adams, there's a place called the E-City Ranch. And E-City stands for Enlightened Contact with Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And they, so Jim Gilliland has operated this place for decades, and people come from all over the world, and you hang out on his lawn with lawn chairs, and you watch UFOs fly around Mount Adams all night. Tons of videos. You go to eseti.org, you can see some of them. And they claim to be in contact with several races of extraterrestrial intelligences, and one of them happens to be a race of feline humanoids. The race that they claim to interact with has the body of a human and the head of a lion or a cat. The creature we're talking about is kind of the opposite. It's got the body of a cat and the head of a monkey or a man. So, again, another possibility. But interestingly, the most rational explanation is that it escaped from the Hanford nuclear facility, which is just upriver from us. And it kind of blew me away once I sort of did a deep dive on what they were doing out there, that turns out to be the most rational explanation for what people are seeing. So to give you a little bit of history, during World War II, the Allies were terrified that the Nazis would unlock the secrets of the atom before we did. And so they spun up the Manhattan Project. And everyone knows that Oppenheimer was down in Los Alamos with all the engineers designing the bomb. But up in Washington State, they needed a place where they could actually forge the plutonium that would be used in these nuclear weapons. And so the U.S. government came in and it basically took over 600 square miles of land along the Columbia River. And they evicted everyone who was living there. And they told the Native Americans, we don't care that you've got spiritual ancestral lands here and burial sites. You have to leave because we're doing something super top secret. And so they built the world's first industrial scale nuclear reactor there. Over the years, as the Cold War went on, they wound up, I think, building 8 different reactors out there. And they forged enough plutonium to create 60,000 nuclear weapons. People call it the Apocalypse Factory because it is the place where all that happened. But so they had this special site, right? And so, of course, everyone understands that we were worried about the Nazis developing the bomb. But the Nazis were also really interested in creating super soldiers and super animals and all kinds of crazy Nazi science things. And in the 1940s, we knew that radiation could induce mutations, but we didn't know much more than that. In fact, the medical research that happened at Hanford is really what produced a lot of the medical knowledge we have about radiation, its effect on biological creatures. So from day one, the Manhattan Project had the Hanford site, and they had an animal testing program going on there. The guy that they picked to run it is a guy named Dr. Lauren Donaldson, and he was from the University of Washington. And his only academic achievement before getting this posting was that he had actually created a super animal. It's called the Donaldson Super Trout. It's a viable fish species today, but this is a creature that is 8 times larger and stronger than a normal trout. It reaches sexual maturity in half the time. It's super survivable. It can live in fresh water and salt water. And it was this creature that through, you know, retrobreeding and everything else, he had actually brought into life. And the Nazis actually had brought back an extinct Ice Age creature called the aurochs. It's this giant, hyper-aggressive bull. And they populated a whole forest in Poland with them. And so they had this animal testing program going on from the very beginning. And so, and it was a core part of what they were doing. So we dropped the bombs, right, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We win the war. They announced that Hanford was a thing. It helped win the war. And then the Russians start scooping up Nazi scientists at the end of the war. So we panic and we create this thing called Operation Paperclip. And we start scooping up Nazi scientists as well. And so Hanford then goes into overdrive, and they start building more nuclear reactors there. This is going to be America's most important strategic site because it's going to be where we build the fuel for all of our nuclear weapons during the Cold War, right? Because the Cold War is now spinning up. So Donaldson winds up going to the South Pacific, and he's part of like Bikini Atoll test and the disastrous Castle Bravo test and all that crazy South Pacific stuff that gave rise to the Godzilla mythology. But he stays in contact with the new guy at Hanford, a guy named Bill Baer. And Bill, under Bill's leadership, the animal testing program blossoms, and they can house over 1,000 large animals there at a time. Propaganda films called it the Atomic Zoo. And so on the surface, they say, we're testing to see what happens to livestock if it's exposed to radiation. Can you drink cow's milk? Can you wear sheep's wool? All that kind of stuff is what they're saying on the surface. But in secret, they're doing all kinds of crazy tests, right? And there's a horrifying story. It's called the Green Run, where basically they took the filters off the smokestacks of the reactors, and they irradiated 200 square mile areas of the civilian population without telling them. And then they secretly tracked their medical records for decades. And so they were doing lots of crazy stuff out there. Well, so Hanford closed down in the 80s when the wall came down in Berlin and, you know, we won the Cold War. And so Bill Baer did a bunch of oral history interviews, so videos, and you can watch him. And he talks about his experiences out there. And I was going through trying to figure out what the heck were they doing with this animal testing lab. And he launches into this story about how they were irradiating apex predators, and they escaped. And so he describes it that they had a whole flock of alligators, up to 30 of them. And they were doing radiation experiments, X-radiation experiments on these alligators. In fact, in one of these interviews, he holds up a picture of the device they were using to irradiate the alligators. And, you know, you can actually see alligators in the device at the time. It's this weird plexiglass thing. And he tells the story of how one night, 6 of these experimental apex predators outsmarted the scientists and escaped their pens and got into the Columbia River. And so that's kind of a shocking thing to hear, right? Like, well, we've got irradiated apex predators swimming around out there. And you can find press releases at the time. So apparently one gator had escaped before, and it got into the river, and a fisherman caught it. And he stuffed it and put it into a sporting goods store. And the folks at Hanford found out about that. And so they had to go in with like hazmat suits and remove this thing because it was radioactively hot. And so when these six skaters escaped later, they realized that this could be a PR nightmare. So they actually put out a press release that sort of softballed what had happened. But there is historical documentation that says this was a real event that occurred. And so for 6 months from July to January, they had this covert army hunting team trying to hunt down these irradiated gators. And in the end, they only captured four of them. And there are still two at large. And this is right out of the mouth of Bill Baer, the guy who was running the program. And he says that they called off the search. They didn't think the gators could survive the winter. And so they figured, we can't find them after 6 months. We're just going to call it off. But Bill Baer in these interviews says that even into the, well into the 80s, he was getting calls from fish and wildlife guys asking if he knew anything about gators in the Columbia. And he always just said no and hung up on them. Like, and then in the interview, he laughs about it. Like, it's hilarious. And so we know for sure, there's no question, it's a historical fact that at Hanford, they were doing radiation experiments in apex predators. Wow. And, you know, you can understand like the livestock thing, like that sounds like critical survival of the country kind of stuff. But we don't get milk or fur from gators, right? Like, it's not like gators are on the menu for everybody. So it's not like one of the common food sources. So why are they doing that? You have to go back and understand some more of the crazy Cold War stuff that was going on. So since 1958, the U.S. government has used dolphins to protect some of our most sensitive nuclear sites. And the reason why is that many of our nuclear sites, like our nuclear sub bases and anything that's got a reactor, is going to be on the water. And the biggest fear that you have is that you're going to have Soviet scuba divers coming in, probably at night with night-vision goggles, and either surveilling what you're doing or sabotaging it or causing some kind of trouble. And so it's really hard to detect a diver in the water. Like if you use sonar, you don't know if that's a diver or a sea lion or a dolphin or a tuna or whatever it is. But you can train a dolphin to figure that out, to know the difference between a diver and a normal, you know, aquatic animal. And so they would rig the dolphins with a special apparatus on their snout. It was sort of like a harpoon. And they would train the dolphin to ram that harpoon into the flesh of the diver. A balloon would inflate, and it would bring the diver to the surface, and then security forces would come scoop that guy up and, you know, gather intelligence about what was going on. A dead diver at the bottom of the ocean doesn't tell you anything. You really want to kind of know what's going on. So we know that the U.S. government used animals to protect our most sensitive nuclear sites since 1958. And of our nuclear sites, Hanford was the most important. And it had, you know, four Nike missile launch sites out there. But you can't bring dolphins in there because the Columbia River is freshwater and dolphins only operate in saltwater. So, and to be sure, like Hanford has got the 45 miles of the river go through Hanford. So that's 90 miles of river coastline. You need to somehow figure out how you're going to guard. And if you're a zealous cold warrior and you're seeing the success of the dolphin program in saltwater, you're going to ask yourself a really simple question. And that is, what is the world's most effective river hunter? Like, we got the dolphin super effective saltwater hunter. What can we train to be our freshwater version of that? So, of course, you might try alligators, see if they work out. But you would also check out jaguars, because it turns out jaguars are one of the world's most effective river hunters. These creatures can hold their breath for up to 15 minutes. They can swim a kilometer in the open ocean, pound for pound. They're the strongest of the big cats. They have night vision that's six times better than a human being. They can eat underwater, and they always, always, always instinctively drag their prey to shore. So if you're going down a checklist of like, what's the kind of creature that we want as a base creature for the thing we're going to train to guard our nuclear facilities, jaguar jumps out as the number one choice at the top of the list. So what we think happened is that just like the alligators, they were doing radiation experiments on a Sentinel program, a Guardian program, where they were trying to train jaguars to guard the river coastline for the Hanford nuclear site. And, you know, when you're training an animal, you don't want it to attack humans on site. You want it to, you know, you want it to be able, the handlers to be able to interact with it. And then under certain commands or conditions is when it attacks people. And so we think that these creatures, just like the gators, outsmarted the scientists and escaped from their pens. And then once they were out, they couldn't recapture them. And if you look at how Hanford is situated, basically, if you go north, east or south of Hanford, you just head deeper into desert. But if you head west, there's tons of habitat and available food sources, and all the things that a big cat would need to survive are headed west into Klickitat County. And so here we are, you know, decades later after the Cold War, and we have over 100 reports of enormous black panther creatures living out here. And it seems like that's the most rational, non-supernatural explanation you could get as to why we've got these strange creatures being sent into here.
Well, I really love how you can really connect the dots and you do your research. You know what you're talking about. So I really appreciate that, because that takes a lot of work and time to really research.
But it's so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really neat to, you know, we have the field reports. You know, to me, that's the most interesting thing. Like, a non-intellectually curious mind would dismiss it as black cats are impossible, and that's the end of the story. But what that's saying is that the 100 people that have come into my store, stopped me in the grocery store, at the post office, are a bunch of liars, and or they're crazy, or they're stupid. And I have a lot more faith in my, you know, my neighbors and the people who live in the area to not just jump to that assumption that these people are crazy or they're stupid or they're ignorant or whatever. And if you look at the data, you say, okay, well, there's a phenomenon that's happening here. What are the possibilities? And I stumbled across an article where they had found, so Hanford is like a Superfund cleanup site. They were not only doing radiation out there, but they had tons of like super toxic chemicals and all kinds of like just bad news was going on out there for decades and decades and decades. And they've been cleaning it up. And I ran across an article that said they found a boxcar filled with irradiated animal carcasses that was buried in the desert. And from there, I started to, you know, do the research and figure out what was going on with the animal testing program. And wow, it just was super fun and really satisfying to dig in and to find, holy cow, there are some really legitimate, you know, threads to pull on here to learn about what may have been going on. It's just pretty phenomenal. But I can't say that, you know, that's 100% the answer. You know, there are some features, you know, multiple people have reported strange electromagnetic effects in the presence of this creature. Other people have reported that it has sort of vanished from sight as, you know, as it, they were interacting with it.
Wow.
And again, you know, those are scattered and hard to really make a definitive statement about one or two reports. And kind of what we like to do is look for patterns in the data. And so yeah, in our store, we've had this map up. It's the sort of the one over my shoulder for those of you who listen to, also can see the video. And, you know, we point to all the different locations on the map where things have been encountered. And now that we've got over 300 reports, we put together this paranormal info center, the Gorge Paranormal Info Center in the store. And just the other day, I finished building an 11-foot-tall hairy Sasquatch that we have in the store that you can come up and pet and see what it's like to stand next to these things. Most of the reports of squatches that we get are like between 7 and 10 feet tall. The tallest we've ever heard is 14 feet, which is just an enormous thing. But I wanted to see, like, what is it like to stand in the presence of 11 feet of fur? And so we've got this big, we call him Jeff, and Jeff loves to be petted. I just ordered a replica skull of the Panthera atrox and that big cat that we talked about. And this thing is 18 inches long. And we also ordered a cougar skull so people could see the difference between the two. And so for me, part of the joy of this whole project is gathering this data and then communicating what we're learning. And so going on shows like yours is really a joy for me to be able to share some of the stuff and, you know, hear what other people think and, you know, get mixed up with some other theories and ideas about it.
Yeah, thank you. I know that Thich Nhat Hanh, he was a Zen master. He said, the further we go away from nature, the sicker we become. And when I think about that, maybe we start to lose, we're not as in tune. Our intuition starts to, you know, go away. And then our spiritual vision. You often hear about Bigfoot going in and out of realities or like phasing out cloaking or and so on. What kind of experiences have you heard or you experienced or people that come into your store about Bigfoot and, you know, being super fast or disappearing all of a sudden from reality?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting story. We've had multiple Bigfoot encounter stories that also include glowing orbs. And so to me, that's really fascinating that those two phenomena seem to be related or happening at the same time for some folks. So that to me is really, really interesting. That there's some kind of connection between that. We also have heard reports of people who, like there's one guy who apparently there's sort of like a Sasquatch travel pinch point on his property. It's probably, you know, 7 or 8 miles away from our store. And so he has had numerous encounters. He's even brought us in hair samples and all kinds of stuff. Like it's a pretty... He's had a lot of encounters. He's seen juveniles. He is the guy who saw the 14-foot tall one. Wow. He's seen them, you know, blonde hair, brown hair, black hair, white hair. And so he has got a lot of experiences with them. And I asked him, do you think this is a biological creature or that it's something supernatural? He said, oh, it's definitely a biological creature. It's an animal. And then he said, but it seems to have the ability to teleport. Well, I don't know if that's a normal biological creature thing to do, but all right. And so what he says is that, you know, you could be looking at them and they'll be walking away from you. And then suddenly they sort of like blip forward 50 yards and either they're moving at this unbelievably fast rate of speed or they're sort of somehow like teleport jumping. And, you know, we hear that kind of thing. I wouldn't say often, but more than a few times. We've also had a number of folks tell us that they have had So there's an area probably 15 miles northwest of the store. It's called, on the maps, the Monte Cristo Natural Preserve, but all the locals call it Monster Mountain because there have been so many Sasquatch sightings and reports in this area. People have reported, you know, rocks being thrown into their campsites, conversations between multiple creatures around their campsites. We've had, you know, stories of strange encounters and, you know, knocking on wood and things like that. And so that Monster Mountain area is one of those real hot spots. And people who are out there report like having a strange encounter, you know, like seeing it or whatever, and then walking back to their car, and there's a whole block of time and distance that they have no memory of. Like suddenly they find themselves next to their car and they don't remember the space in between, you know, where they started from and how they got so close to their car. Like it seems like there's a time displacement, a space displacement kind of effect going on. That doesn't seem like the thing a biological creature could do to you if in fact the Bigfoots had anything to do with that experience at all. And so, yeah, and that one, I'm kind of on the fence. You know, we've got evidence, you know, clear evidence that this is a biological creature with that makes footprints and leaves hair and leaves droppings and has children and does all those other kind of things. And then we have other, you know, reports, a lot of glowing orb reports. I've seen them myself with my bare eyes and they seem to be associated with this. The creatures are incredibly elusive, very difficult to spot. And so this reported teleportation ability. So there seems to be something that's, they're not, let's just say, just like the talk radio, classical music, rock and roll music thing, they don't live in the talk radio banned all the time. They may, you know, fall into that band from time to time, or we may fall into their band, whether it's a classical music band or however far I want to take this analogy, but you kind of get the idea that I think like they're always here. Like they're part of our environment. It's just that whatever frequency they're on is different from our normal perceptive tuning. So wow.
What about shape-shifting? Do you hear anybody here talk about Bigfoot shape-shifting into like a different animal?
You know, I have heard secondhand reports, but I don't have a lot of firsthand reports of that particular experience. Other than shape-shifting from a glowing orb into a Sasquatch, mm-hmm. I don't have many reports of it going from animal to animal. Now, I will say that we did have a report. So there's an individual driving through the desert. This is after 1 a.m. in the morning. And this is their route home that they go. And many times in this exact area where they had this experience, they had seen owls standing in the road or along the side of the road. Unusual, wow. Just that owls were out there doing that. Like, it's not a, just seems weird to see an owl standing there, right? Well, one night, this individual was driving through that exact part of the road, and they saw a 2.5-foot-tall bipedal humanoid that seemed to have a head that looked like a praying mantis. And again, you know, I'm reporting the data that was reported to us. And I know this person very well. I don't think that they were making it up. As they drove by it, they were like, they only saw it for a few seconds. It was no taller than the hood of their car. As they drove by it, their car console went dark and their phone started acting crazy and all the alarms started going off on it. They got about 100 yards past it, and then they started feeling dizzy and nauseous. And he looked and he thought to himself, James is really going to know about this. Maybe I should go back and check that thing out. And he thought, nope, not going back and checking it out. I don't care how much James wants to hear about it. And so then he continued his journey home. And so there we have a situation where whatever this bipedal creature was, skinny, big-headed type of thing, it was in the same place where owls have often been experienced or seen. And so to me, like, that's as close as I've come to a direct sort of transmutation type of story.
Wow.
There's another one sort of in the shadow of Mount Adams. A family was camping, and they encountered this group of or a pack of whistling creatures. Like, they were sitting on the campfire, and they were whistling, and they whistled back, and the whistles got closer and sort of surrounded the camp. And then they saw what they described as almost, they were gray, hairless, dog-like creatures that seemed to be able to move very fast and whistle. And as soon as the sun began to rise, they fled almost in terror. And so what those things were, again, it's a one-off report, really hard to make any kind of definitive statement about it, but really interesting stuff, a lot of unusual activity.
Yeah, speaking of Mount Adams, you talk about the, I've heard you share about the Kenneth Arnold report about UFO hangar. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can touch on that for us briefly, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so Kenneth Arnold, back in June of 1947, he was basically the first guy to have seen a UFO and have be reported widely. So he was a private pilot. He was flying from Western Washington to Eastern Washington, right past Mount Rainier, which is sort of like the next mountain up from ours. And he saw 9 saucer-shaped craft flying at speeds and performing maneuvers that were impossible for the aircraft at the time. They zipped past him, and they actually flew towards Mount Adams. So past Mount Rainier, south towards Mount Adams. And so he made this report, and it got into all the local newspapers, and thus America's fascination with flying saucers really kicked off at that moment. And so it's kind of like the beginning of the UFO American fascination. Mm-hmm. But since then, we've had an incredible number of UFO reports around Mount Adams, and there are some folks who swear that and I've seen pictures of it that say that there's an actual physical hangar door that opens up towards this summit. There's basically a false summit below the main summit. And they see lights and things flying in and out of that.
Wow.
We've also had reports of a portal sort of floating in the sky adjacent to the summit. And just a few reports like that, and not sure what to make of it. But we certainly have had multiple reports of what people describe as portals, which basically looks like a space where it's typically circular, and background behind it, the landscape or the sky behind it, is different than the sky around it, in a really obvious and unusual way. And recently, we have a couple of different flavors of UFOs that people see, but recently we've had a lot of reports of triangular-shaped UFOs, and oftentimes they're black with lights, but many folks report them as looking like they're cloaked, like light is bending around them. And so, like, you can see the stars sort of like rippling as this enormous 100 foot to 300 yard wide craft flies by. And so it appears, and again, just repeating what the reports say, that there are triangular shaped craft, enormous in size, fairly slow moving. They're able to bend light. And we've had some reports that they're actually transmedium craft. The gentleman driving on Highway 14 back in 1988 said that he and his passengers saw this craft from 400 feet away flying above the river, and then it dove into the river, and they could see its lights underwater.
Wow.
And so they called the FAA and asked if any planes had crashed, and there was no reports of that. So again, lots of strange and interesting phenomenon related to UFOs. In my mind, they seem somehow related, but I don't have a great theory as to exactly how yet.
Wow. Have you ever got any reports of a UFO being blended in with the clouds in the sky?
Yeah. So a lot of these triangular ones are like that. And people say that it's most obvious that you're looking at this triangular-shaped craft at sunset and sunrise when the light is sort of transitioning, and it seems like whatever cloaking technology, for lack of a better word, they're using as difficulty when the sky is changing like that, you know? And so you can see the ripples in the clouds and things like that a lot more clearly.
Yeah. Cause I recently seen one where it was a disc shape, and, it was transitioning into nighttime, and, it was pretty much, blended in with the clouds, but it was pretty obvious that was a craft. And what got me was no one else stopped except me to look at it. Everyone just kept going by.
So. This one woman was yelling at her husband, "Look, it's right there. Look, it's right there." And he couldn't see it. Like, he wasn't understanding what she was pointing at, but she was absolutely certain that she could see it. And so I don't know if that's like, you know, your perceptive capabilities or your openness to the experience or whatever it is, but it seems like it's not an easy thing to see, and only like if maybe if you are lucky enough to catch the edge of it at a certain transition point, the whole thing can sort of become clear in your mind. But yeah, people standing right next to each other like miss it. And so it's a pretty rare perception to be able to actually see it and notice it for what it is.
Well, thank you. And how can we find you, your links, and do you give tour guides?
I've been wanting to do that for a while. It's just starting to get it all organized. You know, one and a couple of businesses and everything else. But the best way to keep track of us, first, go visit margesoutdoorstore.com. And some of our paranormal stuff is, some of the stuff people reported is up there. Our paranormal reporting forms are there. You can file a report online. So that's one venue. We also have been posting more and more on Facebook, the quick summaries of some of the paranormal reports as they come in. We're on YouTube and Instagram, and we're trying to make those channels a little bit more robust. But please come visit. So we are in Bingen, Washington, which is right across the river from Hood River, Oregon. You can get here by coming down from the Portland airport or from the Seattle airport, drive down I-5, get to Highway 14, and head east. So Benjamin, Washington, please stop in the store or check us out on Facebook, Margie's Outdoor Store, YouTube, and Instagram.
Yeah, thank you. Have you ever heard of the term namaste?
Yes, I have.
Well, you guys should use at your store, Weird Muste. The weirdness in me honors the weirdness in you. So I appreciate you coming on, James.
I love it. That's awesome.